a bit about methods that I actually use, well, modern methods that I use to assess brain function. We've been talking quite a lot, well, one of the lectures when I looked at the history of neuropsychology, I talked a bit about the kind of mainstay of neuropsychology, the kind of lesion study. And I've kind of used patients that have a tilt of their brain to infer what the function of the bit of the brain that is missing actually is. Yeah? Now, that, and I also talked about past our problems, one problem being that these lesions vary in size quite considerably across different patients. That often these lesions come from very different causes, so it could be a brain tumor, it could be a stroke, and that has an effect, of course, on other brain areas as well. But most importantly, one of the main problems with lesion studies is that you're trying to assess the function of a bit that is actually missing. So, the neuropsychology has actually moved on from that by developing or taking advantage of other methods that can be used to assess brain function. And those are the methods I want to talk about today. So they're really kind of structured into two sections. So firstly, I want to have a brief look at methods that I use to assess the structure of neurological damage, essentially that I use to show where the holes in the brain are, and as that structural imaging of neurological damage. But then there's also a range of methods that actually allow us to look at the physiological function of the brain, that allow us to look at the healthy brain in action. And those are the basic methods that I'm going to talk about, like single cell recording and lesion studies where the lesion is placed very precisely. Those are usually done in animals. And then I also want to have a look at some of the non-invasive methods that are available today, like positron emission tomography, functional MRI, recording of the electrical field of the brain, and I want to talk briefly about transmagnetic stimulation. And then to finish off, I want to have kind of a little look at what these things can actually tell us. And there I'm going to get a little bit on my horse, because my personal opinion is that these are the results of these methods are often very much overinterpreted, but I'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of the lecture. Okay, right, so we'll start off with structural imaging. And one method that I'm sure all of you have come across is CT or computer tomography. It's one of the oldest methods that's been used to look at the structure of the brain. And essentially, it's an X-ray of the brain. And the way it works is that you have, essentially, the patient lies in this long tube, and wherever you want to take the X-ray of the tissue, then you have X-ray emitting diodes on one side, you have these kind of detectors on the other side of the body, and what happens is that these tubes emit X-rays, and these X-rays obviously have to pass through the tissue. And you all see the mouse moving in. Yeah? Okay, good. These X-rays, these photons that cross the tissue, are on the way absorbed by the tissue. And depending on what type of tissue they go through, more or less of these photons get absorbed. And the rule of thumb is that the least dense tissue absorbs least photons, and the densest tissue absorbs the most. So both will absorb most of the photons, whereas, for instance, the cerebrospinal fluid, which is essentially water, absorbs very few photons. And what you then create is something like this. This is a typical CT image. So you can see really dark areas here, which is essentially where the brain is filled with water, and these are ventricles. You can see these really light areas, which are in the brain, which is the skull. And then in between, you see these various shades of brain. You can see blood vessels, for instance, here, which are slightly darker than actual brain tissue, but not as dark as the ventricles, which are filled with cerebrospinal fluid. And that way, unfortunately, didn't find a picture with an actual hole in the head, but that way you will see very nicely where lesions turn up, because lesions are very, very dark, because they are essentially filled with water. Okay, so that's the CT, very crude measure of structural damage, but nevertheless a very useful measure because it can be done easily and cheaply. So NHS will use this, for instance, to assess damage after stroke. in the present. Okay? Now the other method that seems to have been around the structure, and I'm sure you've all come across that as well, is magnetic resonance imaging or MRI. How many of you have actually been in an MRI? So maybe, you know, 5 years ago, we would have been 50. But of course, you know, most people actually have a pretty good idea what I'm talking about. Okay, so MRI takes advantage of the fact that that there is aggregate of magnetic property. So what happens in an MRI scan is we're getting the head or the body lines in the scanner, and the scanner actually has very strong magnetic field. And that means that all magnetic incentives in the body will align with that magnetic field that's kind of shown here. So in a normal state, you know, all these particles will be kind of pointing in all sorts of directions. The thing is, you go into the MRI scan, they will all align in the same direction. So that's kind of in the state which you're in before anything starts. Now, what happens then during the actual scan is that the second magnetic field is superimposed on the field that the scanner has anyway. And this happens as a kind of, it's called a radio wave. And for those of you that have been in the scanner, it's that clocking noise that happens, that really loud noise. That is the second magnetic field that gets switched on and off. Okay, so what happens is that the second magnetic field gets switched on for a very brief time, and that means all these particles will align in a different direction. They're all spin around. So you get this state, and then the magnetic field gets switched off again, and they all slowly start spinning back into the direction of the magnetic field that the scanner has anyway. Now, around the scanner, there are a lot of receivers again, and each receiver can recall the signal that's emitted from these particles when they spin back. So what they actually look at is the time it takes these different particles to spin back into alignment with the scanner's magnetic field. And that is essentially what these pictures are based on. The computer can then kind of make use of the time it took, and the time it takes depends again on the tissue. So for instance, time for the spin back is longer, it's different in the kidney than in the liver than in the brain, and in the brain it's different for grey and white matter. So this is kind of what can come out with all these nice structured images, because computers are clever and they can determine from where these signals come and in what strength, and that tells them what tissue they come from. So that's all there is really to magnetic resonance imaging. It's all based on magnetic properties of particles we have in our body. Okay? Okay, so just like you can see, what structural MRI does, it gives you a static picture of the brain, which allows you to look exactly where, for instance, there's damage. An example I have here is a tumor, which you can see nicely outlined in red here. And these are ventricles, and you can see here that tumor has already kind of grown into the ventricle. And this is the example I found where the tumor is after radiotherapy. You can see that a few weeks later, when radiotherapy is stopped, the tumor has grown again. But it gives you a very, very accurate picture of where things actually are and what that's going wrong with the brain. Okay? Okay, so those are kind of the main the methods that many use to assess structural damage. So now I want to move on and look at some of the methods that can be used to look at the healthy brain in operation. And so first I want to talk about a couple of invasive methods that are used, and the research are mostly used in animals, and in finger cell recording. And lesion studies, again, including studies that allow you to place lesions very exactly. Now, these methods are based on the idea that a certain species of animals have similar brain structures to ours. So most species of animals will have frontal lobes. Most of them will have a hippocampus. So the idea is that you can develop models so that when, for instance, you make a monkey learn when you teach a monkey to do a memory task, remember things, the idea is that in the monkey brain, similar brain structures will be engaged as in the human brain. So the monkey has a hippocampus, the idea is that for this type of memory task, the hippocampus will be engaged in the monkey just as it would be in a human being. So, single cell recording and lesion study they very much take advantage of the idea that there's overlapping structures and that likely for similar paths, these structures will be engaged. Now, single cell recordings are a very interesting way of looking at brain function because they allow you to visually look at what single cells in the brain do. That's impossible in humans. And the way this is done is that an electrode is lowered down into the brain to a particular point, and then you can record the activity of that particular neural. So the example that I have got here is, for instance, one of visual cortex. So for instance, here you can see that the electrode goes into the monkey's brain, and the monkey then has to look at light bars on a display screen. Now, whenever the light bars are moved through the receptive field of that particular neuron, the neuron will start to fire, and that's what we see here. So we have the light bar in the receptive field, and you can see that there's lots and lots of activity. Essentially, what we look at is the action potential that this neuron creates. And then as the light bar moves away from the receptive field of this neuron, the activity gets slower and slower until it kind of goes back to essentially baseline. And from this, you can kind of conclude when given an animal a certain task to do, what tasks of the neurons are involved in. And mostly this has to be used to look at vision or hearing, because you can pinpoint quite exactly which neurons are involved in which aspects of vision and hearing. So for instance, motion versus colour, orientation, I guess. So that's a single cell recording that can only be done in animals, can't be done in humans. Very useful method to look at activity of single neurons. Then the other method that's used very often is the lesion method. The reason behind doing the lesion studies is, again, that when you do this in humans, you have to rely on the lesions that happen naturally. And these lesions very often are fairly big. And also stretch over several structures. Doing this in a controlled way allows you to pinpoint the lesion to a particular structure or part of the structure so that you can look more precisely at what this structure does in the context of the whole system as opposed to single neurons. And the way this is done is that again, a cannula gets lowered into the brain, and this is done by a stereotactic surgery. So the amount that you get put their anesthetized at that point gets put into this contraction, and they are very, very accurate maps of the brain that help coordinate where you will find each particular structure. So the cannula can get lowered to exactly this particular structure, and then there's various ways of knocking out the structure. One is by injecting the neurotoxin that will destroy the cell body, so that particular structure won't exist anymore, which also, of course, means that any axons, instead of anyone else, won't work anymore. And there's something called cryonic blockade, which essentially freezes the cells in that particular area. And the other interesting thing you can do is, if you want to target fiber tracts or connections between different areas, you can actually section them and cut through them, so that two areas of the brain then all of a sudden can't talk to each other anymore. And these are all these kind of methods that I mentioned with relation to humans, at least. So you can create lesions or disconnections in animals, but you can create them very precisely. But again, this all relies on the idea that similar structures in animals and humans will do similar things in animals and humans, which is, I guess, an okay assumption to make, but again, it has to be kind of consumed with caution, because they may do different things in life. Okay? And we have a break. ethics from the land. I mean, would you like to have electrodes stuck into your brain? Okay, people may want to see it. Now, okay, I'm saying there never are, that's not quite correct. So single cell recordings can be done in humans, and so they're sometimes done in the context of brain surgery. So for instance, somebody has epilepsy and they can be treated with medication eventually. The neurosurgeon might, or the neurologist might decide that it's best to remove that bit of the brain. So in preparation for the surgery, Hoffman entered my first into the brain to see exactly where the epileptic fits come from, and that does give us opportunity to record from inside the brain. It's an inexact science, so it can be done sometimes, but it will only be done in the context of surgery. Because the problem with that is that it's actually a damaged brain. So it's a brain that doesn't function normally. So again, what you get out of it, it's maybe not reflective of what would happen in a healthy brain. But yes, you know, you can do it. Lesions is the same thing, but that's not brain surgery, will create lesions, of course. But you know, you can't decide where you're going to put the lesion in the same way you can in an animal. The lesion will have to happen in the place where the damage is, where the bit of brain that effectively needs to be removed. So yes, lesion studies are found in humans, but they're determined by the problem as opposed to where the researcher wants the lesion to be. Okay, away from the invasive methods, on to the more non-invasive methods. And what I want to talk about in that context is test box on emission tomography, functional MRI, and is the recording of the electrical activity of the brain using the gene. Okay, so PET and MRI are so-called hemodynamic measures. They rely on measuring the blood flow in the brain. They do this in slightly different ways, and that's what I'm going to talk about. Now, PET, as I said, relies on recording blood flow. And the basic assumption is that if the big box of the brain is active, it needs more oxygen and glucose, so more blood will flow to the active bit of the brain than to any other bit of the brain. So, for PET, somebody then had the idea that maybe one could just label the blood with a radioactive substance to try and pick up where it gets the most of the radioactive or make most of the radiation from, and that way to try and figure out where the blood goes. And that's exactly what happens with PET. So the subject goes into the scanner. When the task starts, let's say a memory task, the subject gets injected with a radioactive substance into the bloodstream. usually it's oxygen or water that gets labeled with a radioactive particle. And one of the important bits is that these radioactive particles have a very short half-life. That means they start pulling apart very, very quickly. So the radioactivity will disperse within, let's say, an hour or something like that. Okay, great. So the subject then performs the task. So the bits of the brain that are active have more blood going to them. That of course means that also the radioactive substance will go to that part of the brain. Now, because the PET has a short half-life, this radioactive substance will start breaking apart. And when it does that, it emits something called a positron. So that's a particle that comes out of the atom of the radioactive substance. Now, because there's loads and loads of free-floating electrons around everywhere, as soon as this positron comes out of the radioactive substance, it will collide with an electron. What that then means is that we have two so-called annihilation photons or photons. One electron breaks apart and emits two of these photons. There's two things about these photons that I thought in this context. One is that they will always shoot off in 90 degrees to the electron, but 180 degrees to each other. That's quite important. And the other thing is photons travel at the speed of light. So what that means is that when an electron and a positron collide and these photons get sent out, they will go into opposite directions of each other. And because they travel at the speed of light, they will arrive at these detectors that are in the PET scanner at exactly the same time, to all intents and purposes. So computers being clever, they will then register where these photons co-occurred at 180 degrees to each other. And again, that allows the computer to reconstruct a three-dimensional picture of where these photons actually came from. So it uses the radioactive properties of oxygen, or of these, the properties of these radioactive substances, and the fact that these photons will always shoot off in opposite directions to each other to create these kind of maps. So the example here, of course, is a subject that was asked to speak in the scanner. And so the blood flow will go to the area that one is speaking and one here is Bronxelia, which I've talked about before. And these kind of nice red and yellow colours show that there's an increased blood flow to these areas. The way this is created is because there's more radioactivity coming from these areas of the brain than any other area of the brain. Okay? You know, possibly it's just somebody listening to words being spoken, what we can see nicely is what lights up in the genital area here, and also some of the auditory cortex here. Okay, so that's text. Now, one of the disadvantages, of course, of text is that there is radioactivity involved, but one of the advantages is that it actually gives us an absolute measure of blood flow. So we can actually work out roughly how much blood flows there, which can be quite useful if you want to look at the metabolism of the brain. So for instance, in various clinical populations, you can have a look at whether the metabolism of certain areas of the brain differs between the people who are ill and the people who are healthy. So for instance, in depression, very often we find that there is a lower metabolism in the frontal cortex than in people who are not depressed. So that's kind of a very useful application of PET. Now the other method, which of course is almost defined in the media these days, is functional MRI, which is often hailed as the holy grail of cognitive neuroscience, and I'll talk a bit about that later. Okay, functional MRI, just like MRI, just like structural MRI, I should say, relies on the fact that a lot of isotopes in our body have magnetic properties. And for structural MRI, usually it's the water atoms or the hydrogen atoms, I should say, that are targeted. With functional MRI, it's actually a substance called hemoglobin, and hemoglobin is the bit of the blood that carries oxygen. Now, blood that carries oxygen is magnetic. Blood that doesn't have oxygen, deoxygenated blood, is non-magnetic. And functional MRI takes advantage of that fact, that oxygenated blood is magnetic and deoxygenated blood is not magnetic. Okay, right. So what happens if we get a subject going into the scanner? And again, we have our magnetic field, so all particles align with this magnetic field, just as I described earlier. This time we look at the globe and look at the blood. So then our second magnetic field gets superimposed. The first magnetic field, everything spins round, and again we can measure the time it takes the globe to spin back into alignment with the field of the scanner. Now again, just for like PET, just like with PET, the basic idea behind functional MRI is that areas of the brain that are active have more requirements for blood flow. So more blood will flow to areas of the brain that are active than areas of the brain that aren't active. But whenever an area of the brain is active, much more blood goes to that area. Blood goes to this area to carry oxygen to this area than is actually required. Okay? So what that means is that as soon as all that blood shoots off to that particular area, we get an increase in the ratio between oxygenated and deoxygenated blood. Yeah? More oxygenated blood than is needed, so we've got more oxygen, more the ratio is bigger between oxygenated and deoxygenated blood than anywhere else in the brain. And that is basically what functional MRI measures. It looks at where is the change, where is this ratio bigger? Because the bigger the ratio, the bigger the thicker magnetic signal that the scanner can pick up. Okay? And that's how you construct these maps. You look at the whole brain and you look at, so there's kind of like a base rate of turnover, a base rate of ratio between oxygenated and deoxygenated blood, but the areas that are active have a much greater signal because there's more oxygenated blood relative to deoxygenated blood. And this is what you see here. So here we have our little area of active, and that's visual cortex, I would say. So this person is probably looking at something, and this is area of T, so in fact they're looking at motion. And what we pick up is that we have here when it's still, this is kind of potentially your baseline. This is when this area doesn't do anything in particular, so that's the magnetic signal you will recall. But as soon as this person looks at motion, the consent signal change goes on, so the signal goes up, so they will change the signal strength. And that is because there's more oxygen going to that area, and the ratio between oxygen and deoxygenated blood all of a sudden becoming bigger in that particular area. And then you look again, the person looks at the static picture, the person looks at movement, looks at something static. And that way you can use the property of blood flow to measure functional activities in the brain. Okay?
Why
is oxygen essentially magnetic? So if you have more oxygen in the blood, it becomes magnetic. Oxygen is magnetic. Oxygen is magnetic. So if you have oxygen in the blood, that's the blood will be magnetic, but if you don't have oxygen in the blood, it's magnetic. Okay, right. So those are indirect measures. Indirect measures, they rely on measuring blood flow. There is also a method called EEG that looks at the electrical activity of the brain. Now, I don't know whether any of you have an EEG taken, but essentially what happens is you get an electrode attached to your skull, and usually that does something that is not unlike a swimming cap, or really, you know, you get this kind of magnified cap on the head, and it has lots of electrodes embedded in it. These electrodes can pick up and go along electrically in the brain. Now, so if you look at this, for instance, the EEG will look very different depending on what state your brain is in. So if you look, for instance, at somebody in sleep, you'll see there's a lot less activity going on, for instance, than somebody is excited. You get a lot more kind of up and down here. Somebody is really relaxed. They show something called alpha waves. We have these, we've got these really kind of big changes here when they happen in a very determined manner. Okay, so you can record the EEG from the scalp. Now, EEG will always be very still in the scalp, so we need the measure of everything that goes on in the brain, the activity that goes on in the whole brain. That in itself, for neuropsychologists, is actually very useful. What you need to extract is the electrical activity that's related to cognitive function. And that is possible by extracting something called the event-related potential, or ERP, which is shown up here. And there's a fairly straightforward way of doing it. So, for instance, if you have you've got a cap on somebody and you record electrical activity while somebody's doing a memory attack. So you give them a list of words to study, and then you make them, you give them another list of words. And in that second list of words, you have some of the words that you study and some you don't. For each word that they see, they have to decide whether it's significant or not. Okay? So, you have four words, you took a vision, seen this before, and not seen this before. And what you can do is you can record the EEG time-locked to the onset of each of these words in that list. And that allows you to then pick out all these traits that are related to words that somebody correctly said. Yes, I've seen this before, and all the EEG traces to those words that somebody has said correctly said, no, I haven't seen that before. Yeah? And then you average the EEG, all these traces together. And the idea is that any activity, electrical activity of the brain that's not related to the processing of that particular stimulus averages out. So what you're left with is this evoked potential that's evoked by seeing that word and either by remembering that you've seen it or by knowing that you have not seen it. And that's an evoked potential, an ERP. And you can see here quite nicely you have deflections, you know, up and down, peak and trough, and then kind of peters out. And the idea is that these peaks and troughs are somehow related to cognitive processing. And I'll just give you an example. This is kind of very much what you end up with. Don't get put off by this. It's actually much easier than it sounds, or rather than it looks. So here we have exams of six electrodes. These two would be pretty much on your forehead. These two would be slightly further back, but still on the frontal cortex. And these two would be somewhere at the back of the head. These are on the left side, and these are on the right side. So what you see here is three different EMPs for each of those electrode sides. And what you look for when you look at cognitive function is the differences between these different ERPs. So edge of it doesn't matter. But what you can see quite nicely is that, for instance, you get differences here over these two electrodes that are at the back, and the differences are very kind of restricted in time. They happen fairly early on, and then there's no differences anymore. Whereas if you look here at the other side of the skull, on the right, you see that this difference is quite big, but it keeps carrying on. And what you look for is whether these differences occur at different times and in different places. And as soon as you have them occurring at different times or in different places, you can quite confidently say that it's probably different parts of the brain that create these differences. And then you have evidence that it's different cognitive processes that contribute to different experimental conditions. And that way, electrical activity of the brain can actually also help you look at cognitive function. I'm not going to go into the rest of this.
Usually, if you have a cognitive function happening,
barrier will be activated. And in order for all this to function, all these neurons in Brown's area will have to be active synchronously together. They all fire at the same time. We have this wave of stuff going through Brown's area. And what TMS does is it interrupts the synchronicity with which that happens. So it will scramble up what happens, and in fact, I've seen this done. If you hold the magnet over Brown's area, a person who is fluently reading something else and they stop speaking. It's quite scary, actually. So you just scramble it to take the magnet away and it recovers immediately. So the idea of cavity method is that you can create something called a reversible lesion. You kind of lesion the brain in a certain area, but it's not permanent. You take the magnet away and the function recovers. And just like with other lesion methods, the idea is that you can try and investigate how critical a certain area is to a cognitive function. Okay? And that's what all I want to say about CMS. Is there any questions about these methods? Big thing to take away, maybe they've got events measures, just methods like single cell recording, and lesion methods that are mostly done in animals, and allow you to test the structure of single neurology or certain structures. And then we have methods like test methods, which measure blood flow, the idea being that areas of the brain that are active require more oxygen, more blood flow to them, and in the case of test, you label the blood radioactively, so you measure radioactivity in the brain. And in case of fMRI, you measure this ratio of blood that carries oxygen to blood that doesn't carry oxygen. Both of these methods will give you an idea about where the brain function happens. Then you have electrophysiology, or EEG, which gives you an idea about time. If you call it the arteries in the millisecond range, what electrical activity happens in the brain, but it doesn't really tell you where in the brain it happens. Right. So it's all very nice, pleasant, about this method and you understand the physics of MRI, but the big question is, so what? You know, why do we do this? Now, as I've probably said once or twice already, the aim of psychology, of cognitive neuroscience, is to determine the function of neural systems, or rather, what is the relationship between the function of a neural system and behavior. So I've looked at lesion studies to assess the behavioral outcomes of damage. You know, a brain gets lesions by accident or on purpose, and that can tell you something about how that brain then works without being missing. And I think TMS is in, it's a reversible lesion, so again, we kind of scramble up the function of that particular part of the brain and you assess what the different functions are there. Now, the other methods that I talked about, PET, fMRI, EEG, really, allow us to look at the health of the brain in action. Now, why is that important? Because in the end, these measures of brain function are really nothing else than another dependent variable. They're dependent variables just like reaction time or accident data. Yeah? So, for PET, you have more blood going to the Brown's area. But, you know, there's more blood can be quantified, so it's yet another dependent variable. Yeah, would you agree with me on that? Or do you think there's something special about MRI or PET or EEG? I'm quite interested in this because it's just, I think this is a real question. It's not a true question either. Okay, so you just follow me. I think it's just another dependent variable. So the question then becomes, why does it cost an MRI scanner 1.5 million? The room around me costs another 1.5 million. Why invest millions in order to investigate cognitive function? Okay, here I'm going to quickly go through this again. The methods are mainly used to study cognitive function at MRI and EEG. And as I said earlier, they have to be very complementary. So fMRI has good spatial resolution. And one of the advantages of samples the whole brain. But, as I said, also it's an indirect measure of brain activity, relies on blood flow, and it has very poor temporal resolution. The way that more blood flow works, we're talking probably about 12 to 15 seconds from more blood going there to that blood having returned and everything having returned to normal state. EEG, on the other hand, is a direct measure of brain activity. It measures excitatory presynaptic potential can have high temporal resolution, but we don't know where it comes from. Anyway, so why bother with this? Because the hippocampus is expensive, the hippocampus is important. Now, I said earlier, it was asking to look at the function of the healthy brain as opposed to the function of the diseased brain, or the weak brain, I should say. That in itself is good because you can see what the bits actually do as opposed to what the brain does when you start emitting, because that could be very different. The reason why it's worth bothering with these methods is because they can actually be useful to distinguish between competing cognitive theories, and the reason I say this is really twofold. Now, one is that, of course, when you look at the brain and you look at, for instance, the distribution of blood flow or the distribution of electroactivity, you can actually maybe be able to show differences in underlying neural activity, even if they know all the behavioral differences. So, for instance, you have a group of young and a group of, or even, you know, you've got two groups of older subjects, you know, people in their 70s and 80s, let's say. Now, we all know that the people usually have problems with the memory function. But in this case, you might actually have these two groups, and you're showing that their memory function is exactly the same. So they perform equally well or equally badly on a particular memory test. However, you can then see that if you recall, let's say, EEG in one of those groups, it can look very different than if you recall the EEG in the other group. So you can show that one group processes things differently to the other group, something that you would not have picked up had you just relied on accuracy measures, because the accuracy measures behavior and outcome is the same, even though the underlying processes are very different. And that's one very useful thing about these methods. Now, the other thing is, example, let me just try to bring it up so that I don't tell you nonsense. And also what's useful about these methods is that they can actually allow you to look at processes that you would otherwise maybe not be able to isolate behaviorally. So for instance, if you show that somebody has a memory problem, that could be because they may not have encoded this properly, it might never have it might not consolidate, it might not start. Or they may have problems actually with whatever's in there. Now, when you assess memory function behaviorally, you always do this by making somebody do a memory test and you show either they can or cannot remember. But that doesn't allow you to pinpoint it to either encoding, consolidation, or retrieval. Somebody could have a memory problem because they have an encoding problem, or somebody could have a memory problem because they have a retrieval problem. Making them do a memory test won't allow them to distinguish between those two possibilities. Using, for instance, fMRI will allow them to do that because you can design a path, you can, like I say, you can record the brain activity while they encode. You can record the brain activity while they retrieve. So if there are problems, you can now all of a sudden use your blood flow measures to pinpoint where the problem is it at encoding or is it at retrieval? So it allows you to isolate processes that sometimes you cannot isolate behaviorally. So that's all very nice, but, there's a big but, it relies on a good task design. So you need to, and this task design needs to conform to this notion of what's called pure insertion. Right, very nice in a second. Okay, so if we take a basic design that's used with F4, FMI, or EEG platform, you would always compare two tasks, and you always use experimental psychology to compare two experimental conditions. So the example I have here is, you have a task like reading words, apple, and you would have a reference task, just looking at this line of code. Okay? So, you record your brain activity related to reading apple, you record brain activity related to looking at this line of code. What you do when you want to get your results is you subtract brain activity related to reading apple to subtract brain activity related to looking at crosses from brain activity related to apple. And the idea is that when you do that subtraction, what you isolate is the process that's related to extracting the word meaning. Yeah, because if this line of crosses doesn't have meaning, the word apple has meaning. So the idea is the two things differ only in the terms of extracting meaning. And that's the fracture methodology. And the pure insertion bit is that you need to design your task in a way that isolates that one process that you are interested in this case, extraction of word meaning. And that's pure insertion. And any task design, an experimental design that uses these neuroimaging methods really needs to be very good. You need to take great care to try and get the subtraction right so that it isolates the cognitive processes of interest. And that's called pure insertion. We will come across all this next year and the year after, I promise you that. And this is really my hot course when it comes to fMRI. There's a number of assumptions. And one is that there is actually a connection between neural activity and blood flow. We don't actually know what that connection is. All this is basically assumptions. If there's more activity in a neuron, it requires more oxygen and glucose, therefore the blood will go there. So far, it's only an assumption. The other assumption is that there's a systematic mapping between fracture investigating and the structure involved in that fracture. And that means very much that if you have an MRI experiment, an MRI experiment, the structure that lights up for a particular function in one condition should not light up for a different condition as well, so that there's a systematic mapping between that particular function and that particular structure. What I would always like to keep in mind is that fMRI, and this is the reason I talk about fMRI this moment, is because that is what gets flashed across the media. It cannot provide definitive answers. So for instance, an area that I have could only be one of many that are actually involved in a particular function. The way that the data is analysed very much relies on picking the right kind of threshold. And if you pick that wrong, you might actually get a type 2 error. So there might be many more areas that would be active if you had set the threshold but not lower. And that is very much up to the particular researcher. And as I tried to say earlier, the result is ever only as good as the experimental design. So if you don't design experiments properly, whatever you see won't actually tell you anything. And that's that at least the activation can tell us about the structure of the underlying function. But as soon as you see something when somebody claims this structure like that, therefore this particular function needs to be involved, you want to be very careful because that is an inference that you can't actually make on the basis of function imaging experiments. Okay, and that is my particular hobby course because I always get annoyed when I see these things flash across the media where somebody says, well, we have to show that this bit of the brain lights up, therefore that particular process must be happening. So the last one that was in the media, I think, was this lie detection thing. Somebody making the claim, you can show that this area lights up as opposed to that area, you can be pretty sure that somebody's lying. Well, I'm not entirely sure how they came to that conclusion, but one thing I can tell you is that was a very difficult conclusion to make, and I suspect very much that they didn't take great care in actually backing that up. So, the reason I talked about this at length is that next time you see this in the media, think of this lecture and think a little bit about what I've been telling you. And in case you're worried about the exam, I will not exam you on that last bit, because that is very much something for you to think about. It's not in the book, it's in the chapters that are made for reading for this particular lecture. But, you know, it might be worth kind of trying and think about it a bit, because functional imaging is very much part of our lives today. So, I think it's interesting. Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. We're just talking about the way.